Good evening, all the people here in the this small room, and all the people in the big room. Welcome, one and all. Well, tonight is the third class, or the third talk that I'm giving on this classical Zen poem, and it's a teaching poem. In fact, one of the great teaching poems within the Zen tradition. In Chinese, called the Xin Xin Ming, or translated into English in various ways, but I'm kind of preferring trust in mind. Faith in mind is also a very common translation, and there's others. And we don't really know where this poem comes from, but it's attributed to Sheng San, who's called the third patriarch, the third ancestor. Within the Zen tradition. And I've talked a little bit more about that in the previous two talks, and if you have missed, I believe they're all now posted on the Mountain Rain website, so lend an ear to those if you would like. So maybe I should just say the whole poem is a teaching on recognizing and also softening our hold on our own preferences. And preferences has a wide meaning. As I mentioned earlier, it doesn't mean preference in ice cream flavor, but it's more meeting our life, not wanting this, trying to hang on to that part of our life. Maybe ice cream is part of that, depending on how big a fan you are. But I was thinking, you know, this is really, this poem is really just another approach to the first and second noble truths that the Buddha taught. During his first teaching, or his first sermon in Deer Park. Namely, that we experience dukkha, or we experience dissatisfaction, that our suffering, and the root of that is our craving and aversion, our picking and choosing what we want and what we don't want. I was thinking craving really has a twin, which is aversion. They kind of go together. And the first line of the poem goes, "The great way is not difficult for those not attached to preferences." And in that very first line, I think this poem, this trust in mind poem, takes us right to the heart of the teaching. When we can let go, we find the great way is not difficult. For example, when we're attached to our views, clinging to our views, opinions or preferences, we may say to ourselves, and maybe today you've had this experience, say it loud, or at least say to yourself, "I'm right, you're wrong. I'm right, they're wrong." We assume almost reactively that what I think, when I think it, it must be true. Or at least my view, my opinion is the best. The best choice. And if you have a different opinion, a different view, well, you're wrong. You may be a nice guy, a good person, but sorry, you're just wrong. And let me hasten to add, the opposite is also true. And what I mean by that is, oh, if she thinks that, if she says that, it must be true and I'm wrong. That's the same thing, same mechanism in place. My opinion about the movie must be wrong because it doesn't match so-and-so's opinion of the movie. But either way, you know, our preferences, our views, our assumptions always lead us to a kind of constricted place, a place that we can't see and open to a kind of wider vision, a wider place. One of the chants that we do frequently here on Sunday is the Metta Sutta, right? The Loving Kindness Sutta. And it's one of the very earliest Buddhist texts. And if you remember, in the very last lines, they express this teaching of the Trust in Mind poem. And it goes, not holding to fixed views, endowed with insight, free from sent appetites, one who achieves the way will be free from the duality of birth and death. Not holding to fixed views. This not holding to fixed views means not clinging to our preferences, our ideas, our opinions, our evaluations. Doesn't mean they're right or they're wrong, but can we hold them in a way that we're not making them rigid and thereby making our own self, our own minds, our own hearts rigid? It seems these days we collectively tend to idolize opinions and views, especially our own, of course. And we tend to gather around those people that agree with us. We tend to read those websites, those news feeds, that agree with our opinions and ideas. And of course, so many of the websites and internet is designed to reinforce that, right? Without much hesitation, our views, our preferences, our opinions are assumed to be reality. This is the way it is. I think we're all familiar with this. We've all seen this in the media, particularly. I noticed when I was reading some of the interviews with people who are on the opposite sides of, for example, the gun issue in the United States, or COVID mandates, or climate change even, I was struck by how so many take their thinking to be absolutely valid. And those who think differently are wrong. And at least in the interviews, all of this happened without much or any space to consider the opposite point of view. Perhaps you've noticed this too. So, keeping this in mind, let's return to the poem itself, and we'll pick up from where we left off last week. And where we left off is on page 1, in the second column. And it begins, to return to the root is to find the essence. So we're going to, I'd like us to read together again. That was kind of nice. So we'll read, we'll keep reading until it tells us to stop. How about that? And I'll just wait one moment here for technical difficulties to be resolved. Okay? So let's begin together. To return to the root is to find the essence, but to pursue appearances or enlightenment is to miss the source. To awaken even for a moment is to go beyond appearance and emptiness. Changes that seem to occur in the empty world we make real only because of our ignorance. Do not seek for the truth, only cease to cherish opinions. Do not remain in a dualistic state. Avoid such easy habits carefully. If you attach even to a trace of this and that, of right and wrong, the mind essence will be lost in confusion. Although all dualities arise from the One, do not be attached even to ideas of this One. When the mind exists undisturbed in the way, there is no objection to anything in the world. And when there is no objection to anything, ceases seem to be in the old way. When no discriminating attachment arises, the old mind ceases to exist. Let go of things as separate existences, and mind too vanishes. Likewise, when the thinking subject vanishes, so too do the objects created by mind. The arising of other gives rise to the self. Giving rise to self generates others. Know these seeming two facets of the one fundamental reality. In this realityness, there are two from one. And each contains all phenomena. If not comparing nor attached to refined and vulgar, you will not fall into doubt and opinion. The great way is embracing and spacious. To live in it is neither easy nor difficult. For those who rely on limited views are fearful and irresolute. The faster they hurry, the slower they go. To have a narrow mind and to be attached to getting enlightenment is to lose one's center and go astray. When one is free from attachment, all things are as they are, and there is neither coming nor going. We'll stop here. As I mentioned, this is a teaching poem, and of course, being a poem, things are written in a very kind of terse way. And I think even our ancestors probably would rely on teachers, people who came before them, to help unpack this poem a little bit for them. So let's have a look. Going back to that first verse, to return to the root is to find the essence, but to pursue appearances or enlightenment is to miss the source. To awaken even for a moment is to go beyond appearances and emptiness. To return to the root is to practice. This is what we do in our practice. Sitting down on the cushion, following our breath, being aware of our body, letting go of our ideas, opinions, views, and preferences, we calm the heart, and we listen to the inner silence that's there. All kinds of thoughts, of course, bubble up. And in truth, we have very little control over what appears on the screen of the mind. So if you feel badly about that, don't. You have very little control over that. It just comes. And our practice is simply returning gently over and over and over again to the breath, the body. And for brief moments, we rest there, and then gradually longer periods. We slip into a continuous present moment, free of the kind of ongoing inner chatter. The author, Sang San, tells us not to pursue appearances. And I think what he means by this, the worldly glitter, like fame, praise, wealth. But at the same time, he says, don't seek awakening like it's perhaps some other accomplishment to get, another notch on the belt. Maybe all those trips to the gym to get six-pack abs or buns of steel. It's not like that. Just practice, he tells us. Just practice and allow awakening to awaken. And that's pretty hard to do. But that is what is required. At some point, all our ideas about awakening must be left behind. What we imagine about enlightenment is not it. What we think about enlightenment is not it. And so he gently reminds us, let awakening awaken itself. Go beyond your concepts of emptiness or beyond your concepts of the absolute. even for a moment. Changes that occur in the empty world we make real only because of our ignorance. Do not seek for the truth. Only cease to cherish opinions. Well, it is a poem, it is a bit repetitive. But ignorance has a very special meaning in the Buddhist tradition, in Buddhist writing. It refers to the not knowing what is real. And I find this quite fascinating because we assume we know what's real. We assume we understand, or not really understand, but that we know reality. But the Buddhist tradition tells us that's not quite right. We don't really understand or see clearly what reality is. Our life is muddled in confusion between the apparent, this kind of thing, and what we may call the real. And the basic confusion is our fundamental assumption of a separate self. That we are, in a basic and meaningful way, cut off from the world. And the consequence of this ignorance, this delusion, is the dukkha that we experience, the dissatisfaction, the suffering that arises in all kinds of a multitude of forms. And the antidote for this, according to Sangsan, is letting go of preferences, not clinging to our opinions, or views, or ideas, and releasing our reflex of what I think is true. I'm right, you're wrong. In other words, we need to somehow find our way out of our dualistic experience, our dualistic assumptions of how the world is. Me and everything else, right? And when we can do that, we return to what in the poem is called the root or ground of our very being itself. So he tells us, don't seek for the truth. In other words, the truth is not out there somewhere. The truth is not residing in some teaching or teacher or book, hiding in a mountain cave. And nor is the truth somehow in the future. You know, kind of gradually ripening something that you'll get it in the future. If I just practice hard enough, it will come. It has always been and always is present. And thus, Sangsan advises us not to actively seek it, something, to grasp for it, but actually it's a letting go. And I think that's one of the hardest lessons for our, shall I call it, spiritual journey, our understanding of what spiritual practice is, because we're so used to getting something. But it's the exact opposite. It's a letting go of something. And the next little bit there. Do not remain in a dualistic state. Avoid such easy habits carefully. If you attach even to a trace of this and that, of right and wrong, the mind essence will be lost in confusion. Although all dualities arise from the one, do not be attached even to ideas of this one. Well, here again, more encouragement from the great Sensang to let go of of all the extraneous stuff, and simply rest in awareness. Avoid such easy habits of this dualistic view, or me against the world, right? And he says carefully. And I like to emphasize carefully, it's so easy to fall back into, how could he say that? How could she do this to me? What are they thinking? For example, and if we hang on to this dualistic thing, then what he calls the mind essence, which is again a kind of the very root of our being, he says, is lost. Lost in confusion. But what he means is we're lost in confusion, because we're stuck in this me against the world in some way or another. But note here, Tsang Tsang says, do not remain. In the me versus the world view. But I think he's recognizing, of course, we all need it sometime to operate from that view. But careful, don't think it's the only view, or even the primary view. Everything is woven together in the vast jeweled net of Indra. I think most people are familiar with that image of Indra's net, right? In this metaphor, the whole universe is described as a vast, multi-dimensional net, and at each node or each junction, there sits a jewel, and that jewel reflecting the light of all the other jewels. And all those jewels reflecting the light of all the other jewels. It's a beautiful image. I remember when I first read that, being deeply moved. So in this kind of holographic image, we see our deep intimacy and interconnectedness with every being and also every time in the universe. Powerful, beautiful, poetic. And yet, Tsang Tsang reminds us, don't get attached even to this idea. Don't get attached to the idea of oneness. We need to understand that even this beautiful metaphor is just a skillful means, leading us, pointing us in the right direction. So the poem continues, when the mind exists undisturbed in the way, there is no objection to anything in the world. And when there's no objection to anything, things cease to be in the old way, our dualistic way. So I think in this stanza, it's a bit challenging, but it really deepens the teaching. Resting in awareness, in stillness, there is a clarity. There is a seeing and a very awareness of being that is there before the arising of judgment, evaluation, decision, course of action. And he says, rest there. That must be where we are. Because at that moment, we're free from the view of separation, at least for a few moments. And how we habitually see things as outside of us, at least for a few moments, that disappears. That ceases. And the whole web of causes and conditions becomes more apparent. And with that, our response then can be more appropriate. So what he's telling us here is not that, you know, well, everything becomes okay, but he's saying our kind of knee-jerk objection to the world. And there are things, of course, that the world needs fixing. There is great suffering we need to work at, to try end. But he's warning us, careful. It's not out there. It's not cut off from you or separate from you. Please meet the moment without longing for it to be different, not to change. be there. And if we can do that, I think we do see more deeply. And our action, whatever action we take then, will be more skillful, more appropriate. Because we won't see it in the old way. The old way, right? In the old way, of course, is separate. Maybe you have had an experience in your own life of the old way of seeing someone or something or some group of people drops away. Because at least for a few moments and maybe longer, your vision has expanded, being a little more inclusive. I think it often happens, for example, with our parents. At a certain point when we become older, we begin to appreciate them in a wider view, that they too suffer, had causes and conditions that made them a particular way. So, let me continue. When no discriminating attachment arises, the old mind ceases to exist. Let go of things as separate existences, and the mind too vanishes. Likewise, when the thinking subject vanishes, so too the objects created by mind. Oh, I love this part here. The old mind ceases to exist. Boy, don't you wish for that at times? Like, only my thinking would stop. This endless, repetitive chastising or boring mind. And sometimes sitting in zazen, the chattery mind seems rather relentless. Yeah, on and on. And it's also true at times in our daily life. The mind constantly chewing the bone of an old hurt, the bone of anxiety, a bone of jealousy, or a bone of shame. And this is at least in part what Sensang means by the old mind. It is the habitual conditioned mind, conditioned by your previous experiences. And in our zazen practice, we begin by not paying attention to the internal chatter, but focus instead on our breath and body. And when the internal chatter quiets down, and the reason it quiets down, I realized, is because no one is paying attention. How about that? If you don't pay attention to your internal chatter, it begins to quiet down because, hey, it's like suddenly you're alone in a room. There's no one to talk to. Right? Just return to the breath, return to the body. So when that happens, we become aware of our natural, ever-present awareness. And as that sense of awareness ripens, as it kind of deepens, the sense of my awareness, oh, this is my awareness, that also ceases, and there's just awareness, just resting in awareness. So let me ask you, when your mind ceases for the chatter, at least even for a few moments, who are you? In that quiet, spacious moment, or minute, or half hour, who are you? So let's continue on here. The arising of other gives rise to self. Giving rise to self generates others. Know these seeming two as facets of the one fundamental reality. In this emptiness, there are two. These two are really one. And each contains all phenomena. If not comparing nor attached to, refined and vulgar, you will not fall into judgment and opinion. So this verse is really similar to the Heart Sutra that we chant. Almost every service we do the Heart Sutra. Form is no other than emptiness. Emptiness is no other than form. Form is precisely emptiness. Emptiness precisely form. Kind of one version of it. It's a paradox. And one term for this rather confounding paradox of how emptiness and form come together is one term is often referred to, or it's called the relative and the absolute. And the relative, these kind of things that we see, the separateness, and is expressed very poetically in Chinese as the 10,000 things. And the absolute, or the oneness, Dogen calls, for example, the one bright pearl. So, both are true, both present in this moment. Thich Nhat Hanh, in writing about form and emptiness, explains it this way. He writes, when Avalokiteshvara says that this sheet of paper is empty, she means it is empty of a separate, independent existence. It cannot be just by itself. It has to interbe. Interbe is his expression. Interbe with the sunshine, the cloud, the forest, the logger, the mind, and everything else. It is empty of a separate self. But empty of a separate self means full of everything. Empty of our separate self means full of everything. Woven into everything like Indra's net. It cannot exist without all those other things going back in history and all these present things that are here right now. Deeply seeing this, as Thich Nhat Hanh explains it, we don't easily become attached to refined and vulgar. Right. I remember vividly at a longer retreat at Great Vow Monastery, going out one late evening, and they used to have a little dog there. Do you remember that, Kate? They had a little dog, and it was getting so old. It looked horrible. But I remember walking out, it was kind of a moonlit night, and the dog would kind of poo everywhere, indiscriminately. But walking out and looking down and seeing outside the door was dog crap. But in the moonlight, it looked very beautiful. And I was surprised, because in the daytime, I would have a moment at least of disgust, or like roll my eyes. Like, but there it was, shining in the moonlight. And I'm sure other creatures, of course, would look upon the dog poo and think, dinner. Delicious. Okay. Let's quickly look on at the last verse here. Sorry, I'm taking a little bit too long here. The great way is embracing and spacious. To live in it is neither easy nor difficult. Those who rely on limited views are fearful and irresolute. The faster they hurry, the slower they go. To have a narrow mind and to be attached to getting enlightenment is to lose one's center and go astray. When one is free from attachment, all things are as they are, and there is neither coming nor going. The great way is embracing and spacious. To live in it is neither easy nor difficult. Isn't it interesting that he says, it's neither easy nor difficult? Well, wait a minute, I thought this was going to be easy once I got there. But no. Another opinion punctured. Another idea, right, hits the dustbin. Because easy and difficult arise from our preferences, our narrow view, while the great way is embracing and spacious. Spacious enough to hold with equanimity what some people, what some may find fearful. And the great way is embracing enough to include the unknown, the dark, and the unseen. In the first talk that I gave on this series, I mentioned that the great way refers to the path of awakening, the path of being fully alive, fully awake, fully functioning in this universe of interbeing. And this is just one expression among many that our ancestors created to try point towards the ineffable. Sensong points out that the harder we try, the more fixed we are upon our goal, then the slower we're going to go. He warns us not to get attached to some blissful goal where all our woes will cease. This reminded me of that famous koan, the Everyday Mind koan, and Zhaozhou, the famous Zhaozhou, asking his teacher, Nanchuan, what is the way? And Nanchuan said, everyday mind is the way. And Zhaozhou said, oh, good. How should I direct myself toward it? And Zhaozhou says, stupid. If you try to turn toward it, you'll go against it. When one is free from attachment, things are as they are. There is neither coming nor going. Interesting. From one point of view, our life is full of comings and goings, and they're often a source of much difficulty and strong pain. Coming into a new relationship, it breaks, and we leave. We start a new job, it doesn't work out, and we go looking for another. We enter a marriage, perhaps we leave a marriage. We find the perfect apartment, and sooner or later we move to somewhere else. We exercise and become the picture of health, and then we receive unfortunate medical test results. Comings and goings, comings and goings. At first we may think, ah, this is forever. This is beautiful. And we imagine a permanence, of course, that's not there. In the great way, things are as they are. There is no coming and going in the conventional way. Or to put it another way, in this moment, there is just coming. In this moment, just going. Well, my apologies for going on a little bit too long. Kate and I sometimes warn each other, don't. Make it a little shorter. Go on for so long. But do we listen to each other? Well, we do and we don't, just like any old married couple. So I think what I'd like to do, though, is still do a little exercise together. And I thought maybe we could just get in pairs rather than threes, because that way we can do it faster. And I'd like you to consider this. How do you respond when someone says, I know I'm right? I know I'm right. Of course, in regard to something you've done or said or whatever. How do you respond? And what do you feel when I know I'm right arises within you? Okay? Does that make sense? How do you feel?
So is the other corresponding side of that is they're saying, and you are wrong.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. When someone says, oh, I know I'm right, even though you think they're wrong. Like, what arises for you? How do you...
No, or the and, they say, you are wrong.
That's right. And yeah. When they say, when you have the arise that I'm right, then it arises in you. What is that like for you? And if you have a few moments also, just how would you like to respond? Does that make sense? And if that feels like too much, feel free to talk about anything else that I've talked about.